Okay, good afternoon. My name is not Alan Gibber. That may surprise some of you, may come as a shock. I'm Shlomo Kanner. I'm a partner in the Estates and Trust Department of Neuberger, Quinn, Gielen, Rubin, and Gibber. We put Alan on the marketing material, on the flyers, and on the handouts just to get everybody to come to the lecture. Looks like it worked. And then we pulled the bait and switch. So now you're stuck. I hope you enjoy the presentation. And I apologize, Rabbi Heinemann. But seriously, Alan is under the weather. He's ill. We wish him a refuah shlema. He couldn't be here. And he asked if I would fill in for him. And begrudgingly, I was more than happy to comply. It's also my great covet to introduce someone who really needs no introduction, especially here at home in Baltimore, the greater Baltimore, Washington area, but really globally, Rabbi Moshe Heinemann, who I get to share the table with and share this presentation with. Rabbi Heinemann is the Rav of the Aguda of Park Heights. He's the Rabbinic Administrator of the Star K, and he's really the leading international authority on a vast, vast number of halachic issues. So the name of our presentation is Trusts and Estates, Protecting Your Business and Your Loved Ones. In the time we have, we're hoping to go over some big picture considerations, as well as practical, legal, and halachic suggestions relating to one's estate plan and a business succession plan. I think how Rabbi Heinemann and I agreed is that I will speak for a few minutes first. I'll speak about the secular and legal aspects of an estate plan. And then I'll turn it over to Rabbi Heinemann, who will discuss the halachic issues involved with an estate plan, which are many, and they are very complicated. And then we can open the floor for any questions, should we have time afterwards. So we begin, and I think everybody has an outline. We handed out an outline. We begin with the perfect legacy, and this is a sample provision that parents leave for their children. They can leave for their children in a will, a trust, or other estate planning documents. And this is really the gold standard of what we're all trying to accomplish. And here's what the provision says. To our dear children, it is our wish and prayer that the division of our assets not create machlokes or adversity that divides you. Rather, respect each other and join together b'shalom, peacefully, as a family, in harmony. Let goodwill be your guide, and it will serve you well for many years. That is the greatest legacy we can leave you. Again, this is the gold standard of what we're all trying to do with our wealth, with our fortune, for some people that we've amassed, to transfer it over to the next generation, and to do it in a way that really prevents disharmony and prevents disunity. So what are the goals of this presentation? We're going to discuss how to plan for and preserve the greatest legacy that one can leave. We're going to develop an awareness of practical, legal, and halachic issues. Again, there are many halachic issues related to estate planning. We'll discuss division of assets generally, and more particularly, how to divide and distribute assets to heirs, how to prevent fights and challenges after one dies. And then we'll discuss some universal issues with an emphasis on common personal and business related issues. So if we jump right in to the need for an estate plan, and I get this question all the time, why do I need an estate plan? Why create a will? What's the need for it? What is a will? We start with what a will is. A will is the cornerstone or a pinnacle of many estate plans. And it's the instruction booklet where one directs how his or her assets are to be distributed to the next generation, or to a spouse, or to anybody else. One reason for creating a will or an estate plan is a protection of the desired plan of distribution. And what does that mean? We have to understand what happens if somebody dies without a will in order to appreciate what happens if somebody dies with a will. And that is the difference between dying testate and intestate. There are drastic differences between dying with a will, known as testate, and dying without a will, intestate. One of the most common questions that I get, or comments that I get, from young people in particular, I say, I don't need to do a will because my wife knows that I I'm giving everything to her. And a wife will say the same thing about a husband. And that might be very true. And that might be your intent, and that might be your desire. But as Rabbi Heineman will explain, that's not true under halacha. If somebody dies without a will, and they don't provide specifically for a spouse, then that's not true under halacha. It won't go to their spouse. Nor is it true under state law. For example, in Maryland, if somebody dies without a will or intestate, Maryland law says that if there are children, the spouse only gets half. The spouse doesn't get the whole estate. Vitally important to create a will to direct how your assets should be distributed. And what about charitable intent? We're a charitable people. We promote charity. We solicit for charity. Charity tzedakah is an amazing thing, and people very often will leave charitable bequests in their estate planning document. And if there's no will or any other estate planning document, no trust leaving a charitable bequest, then all of those good intentions fall by the wayside and nobody can fulfill those charitable bequests. We've discussed to whom you can leave assets to, but a person can also decide in a will how to distribute assets. We'll discuss living trusts a little bit later in the presentation, but generally a person can choose to leave his or her assets to someone or a group of people outright. That is, I make a distribution to somebody, and they take the check, they deposit it in their account, and they could go on their merry way, and they can spend the money as they wish. Now, in some circumstances, it doesn't make sense. In fact, it's dangerous to do that, to leave assets or to distribute assets to individuals outright. And instead, it makes sense to leave those assets in trust. Those trusts are considered testamentary trusts. Those are wills that are created, or trusts that are created in a will. Testamentary trusts are only created after death, after somebody passes away. And it makes sense in certain circumstances to transfer assets to those testamentary trusts instead of outright. What are some of those considerations? Well, the first is estate tax consideration. This might not be applicable to many people, but if there is an estate tax liability or the fear of an estate tax liability, then transferring assets to a trust can protect those assets and make those assets outside of an estate or not includable in the testator's estate, the person who dies estate. And the IRS and the comptroller's office can't reach those assets to tax them. Another reason to create a testamentary trust is for creditor protection. If assets are left in trust, I'm not considered the owner of those assets. I don't have full access to those assets. And being that that's the case, creditors can't attach those assets. And the courts can't direct that I invade the trust to pay any debtors that I'm, any creditors that I may have. How about protection from a new spouse? So typically, the way that somebody wants to transfer their assets is I'll transfer my assets to my spouse should she survive. If she predeceases me, then the assets will go to my children in equal shares. Well, what if I transfer my assets to my wife and I give her a check outright and free of trust? And then my wife goes and she gets remarried to a new husband. And she takes those assets, my wealth, so to speak, that I was hoping to preserve for my children, and she takes it to her new family. There's a risk and there's a fear that that wealth can now be diverted from my direct line and instead be distributed to the new family's line, so to speak. So what do? We create a trust for a spouse, and we say, you can have access to this money for as long as you live and as long as you wish to have access to it. But after you pass away, what's going to happen with those assets? You don't have control over them to transfer them to the new family. Instead, they'll go to our joint heirs, and that's a way to protect against any undesired outcome. There are also special needs trusts that can be created for disabled individuals. Sometimes, very often, we see individuals that are the recipients of government benefits, and those individuals can be disqualified from receiving those governmental benefits if they receive assets outright. And the government asks, the Medicaid office asks, what is your income? What is your net worth? If a lump sum distribution is distributed out to these heirs instead of being kept in trust, then they very well can be disqualified from Medicaid and Medicare benefits. So we create a special needs trust, the testamentary special needs trust. And what that does is it protects that money, and it only allows distribution to the beneficiaries up to the amount that won't disqualify him or her from the government benefits. So the government takes a look at what the assets are, the access to money, and says, well, we can't reach that money. It's not considered that you own that money, that you have that money. And they allow for the distribution of the government benefits. Perhaps the most common trust that we deal with, and especially for younger families, is trust for minor children. We at all costs want to protect against the unfortunate situation where a husband and wife will be in a car accident, they'll leave minor children. We don't want those assets, their net worth or their wealth, to be distributed down to their children who are minors. And that opens itself up to a whole number of abuses. We don't want a 7-year-old to have title to a house or cars or money that he or she can do whatever they want with. So instead, we leave that money in trust, and we allow the parents in the will, when creating these provisions, to decide how that money is to be distributed. Maybe education, maybe summer camp, maybe support, maybe for a house. And it also allows the parents to decide when the trust terminates, maybe when a child turns 25, 30, or 35. It also allows a parent to decide who the trustees are, who the gatekeepers are, to decide when and how those distributions are to be made. Now, Rabbi Heineman can address this in greater detail. I'm sorry for putting more on your plate. But for Frum people especially, an estate plan is vital for protection of wife and daughters. We touched on this briefly. There are halachic obligations that a husband has to his wife and to his daughters, and there are also practical considerations. Halacha and secular laws vary greatly on division of assets after one dies. As a society, and I'm not trying to be politically correct because there are women here, I think this is true, and I think everybody believes this to be true, that we view a wife as the equal partner of the husband in society. We treat our daughters equal to our sons, but under halacha, a wife and daughter are not equal inheritors necessarily. And there are ways that we deal with these issues by doing a halachic will. There are ways that we protect the interests of a wife and daughters to make sure that they're in keeping with halacha. Another very important aspect of a will, and this is probably the second most common comment that I get, again, from younger people, is, well, I don't need a will because I don't have any assets. I don't have any money. Why do I need a will? So I've yet to find anybody that really doesn't have any assets, that really owns nothing. But even if you feel that your assets don't rise to the level of needing a real estate plan, a will is where we designate guardians for minor children. If you have minor children, it's supremely important to designate guardians in a will. By not taking advantage of the guardianship provisions in the will, and for you not to decide who gets to or who is to take care of your children after you pass away, is essentially telling the state and the courts, you get to decide for me. I'm not going to have any say because I don't want to do a will, but you get to decide who should most appropriately assume guardianship of my children. And you'd be surprised to hear that sometimes the state and the courts don't take the same position as you or your spouse would on those positions of who should be guardian. Now, what are some specific issues that we commonly run into in creating an estate plan? So I'll start with tangible personal property. And tangible personal property really is the basis for the satisfaction of the Bechor and Yerusha provisions. We use tangible personal property to be mekayim those mitzvos. But what is tangible personal property? So assets generally can be broken down, I like to describe them, into two different buckets. Tangible personal property is anything I can touch. Anything that I can move, it's tangible. And that includes jewelry, artwork, furniture, sfarim, books, silver. That's tangible personal property. And the residuary estate, which is the other bucket, is really everything else. The residuary estate is my cash accounts, my brokerage accounts, my real property interests, my business interests. Again, Rabbi Heinemann can speak more about how certain assets are used to satisfy the halachas of Bechor and Yerusha, but generally, again, we use the tangible personal property bucket to satisfy the requirements of Bechor and Yerusha. But speaking about tangible personal property creates a very big challenge, because when it comes to cash, we can divide cash amongst our children in equal shares, and there's no problem. But can we do the same thing with tangible personal property? Can I take a diamond ring and cut it up into five different chalakim, five different slots for my five children? It presents a greater challenge, which really requires a lot of thought on how these assets should be dealt with. So what are some things that people do? Some people leave a document of informal wishes, and those informal wishes are left with a will, and it's included as part of the estate plan, and it directs the personal representative or the executor of the estate to look at those informal wishes as a guide, as direction, so to speak, to look at how to divide those assets amongst children. Other people leave it up to their children to decide. Hey, you get to decide how to split it up, different pieces of furniture, artwork, what have you. And if they can't agree, then the tangible personal property gets sold and the proceeds of the sale gets distributed to the residuary estate and distributed out to the children that way. There's really no right or wrong way to determine who or how tangible personal property is divided. I had a client who said, I want my couch ottoman to go to my second child. I said, okay. I thought it was very sentimental. And when we signed the will, I said, but I have to ask you, what was so sentimental, what's special about this couch ottoman? And they said, nothing. We just wanted him to get something. We wanted to transfer something to him. So there's really no right or wrong way to do this. I've had other clients who go around the house. This is typically an older clients, older couples. Go around their house with yellow sticky pads and say, this family gets this piece of furniture, this one gets this piece of silver, so on and so forth. We have to also understand the nature of how things are titled. Do we own what we think we own, and can we transfer it down through our estate plan? So it's important to understand what's included in our estate. Things that are jointly titled, for example. I own my house jointly with my wife, with my spouse. When I pass away, I can't transfer my house to anybody else, because by operation of law, the surviving joint title holder becomes the full owner of that asset. So now my wife owns that house. I can't transfer that to anybody else. When we talk about TOD and POD accounts, we're talking about transfer on death and payable on death accounts. And those are assets, again, by operation of law, I'll have a brokerage account that I will fill out a designation beneficiary form. I'll designate either a spouse or a child or a group of people who will be the beneficiaries of that account. And those accounts don't go through my estate. Instead, as soon as I pass away, the bank or the brokerage house will call the beneficiary on file who I've previously designated and says, guess what? You're the beneficiary. You get this money. We think about life insurance policies that way. Life insurance policies, we designate a beneficiary. Those are not included in an estate to be able to transfer down to the next generation. I want to speak for a minute about equal versus unequal division of assets. And this is something that comes up very frequently. It's not always the case that every child should get the same share of an estate. We may have a situation where some assets shouldn't be divided evenly amongst children. Especially in firm families, it's not uncommon, for example, to have one child who's learning in koilo and another carrying out a profession or a business. Those children might not need the same level of financial support. So how do we deal with that? It's not an easy parsha, nor is it a halachically smooth sailing road ahead. And it requires a lot of communication amongst family members. It requires a lot of consultation with attorneys to make sure that it's done correctly and it can't be challenged. But most importantly, it requires shelas chacham. It really requires discussing with the rav the pitfalls and the obstacles that become involved with treating different children unequally. Medical directives. So a medical directive is a document. It's not part of an estate plan, so to speak, because a medical directive is only valid once somebody's alive, during somebody's life. And a medical directive is a document where a principal will name an agent as their agent, will name somebody who can make medical decisions for them in case that person, the principal, can't make decisions for him or herself. As you can imagine, there are a number of issues, halachic considerations that come along with end-of-life care, terminal care, different scenarios that one might be able to plan for, but very often one cannot plan for. Because there are so many halachic issues that can be associated with medical decisions, the document that we create has a spot, a provision for a designation of a paisik, where the medical agent is directed to consult a certain rav that's named by the principal in case halachic issues arise. It's also a good idea, and we found this and we've changed our document over the years, to grant all children access to medical information, unless there's a compelling reason not to do that. Sometimes there is a compelling reason not to do that. But we don't want to be in a situation where one child says, I went to the doctors and they wouldn't let me have information about mom's care or dad's care. And the brother was able to have that information simply because he was named as the medical agent, maybe because he's the oldest or maybe because he's a physician or other medical professional. So we, by default, will grant all children equal access to medical information, even if they're not named as a medical agent. So we were just discussing the need for an appropriate estate plan as it relates to a personal estate plan. But how do we deal with a business estate plan? Again, there are many, many issues to consider when deciding how to transfer business interests to family members. It requires thought, wisdom, planning, and prayer. And I would certainly stress that prayer is always the most important, but in this particular case, it's certainly the most important. When deciding who will take over a business or who will run a business, we have to consider all the potential pitfalls, the potential for jealousy, adversity, and the effects that it could have on a family and the business. A business cannot run if there is dysfunction in the business, which is why it's supremely important to be honest and protect against an unworkable partnership. We might want to transfer our business interests and our business holdings to all children in equal shares. If we can see that the children can't get along necessarily or there are fights and disputes outside of the business setting, the business setting is not going to solve those differences. It's not going to solve those issues. It's not going to make people come together. In our experience, business, being partners with one another from a previously strained relationship, will only make it worse. And we have to be honest with ourselves. Do we want all of our children to be involved in a business if it's going to be an unworkable situation? Which is why it's important to establish a succession plan, a clear succession plan. And that succession plan will go through clearly who can and who cannot run the business. Who should be the managers of the business? Should everybody have managerial roles? Maybe only the most business competent child should be able to run the business. You should also spell out the extent of a child's sweat equity and how that's viewed. One child might not have as much capital as another child to contribute to a business. But that child is willing to roll up his or her sleeves and say, I'm really going to be here every morning and I'll work till night and I'll make sure that the business succeeds. If it's not laid out clearly from the start how contributions, either in sweat equity versus capital, are viewed for the business, then it could lead to trouble down the line. And you should consider active versus passive interests. Again, not everybody needs to be a manager in the company. Not everybody needs to be the boss. Certain children are okay just receiving distributions, and maybe they should receive distributions so that they're not hands-on with the business, and you can really prevent machlokes that way. And if you see that there will be or could be anticipated disputes down the line, then it might be a good idea to say, one child, this child will be in the business, and this child will not be in the business. And I will provide for that child. I'll equalize my distribution. I'll equalize my inheritance from a different part of my estate. Maybe they'll get a real property interest that I'm not going to give the other children. Maybe they'll get some other cash or brokerage stocks that I'm not going to give the other children. It's a way to equalize it to allow the business to run smoothly without machlokes and to also prevent machlokes from cropping up in the family structure. I'm going to briefly speak about tax planning. It's just important to understand that the certain tax regimes that we currently live in may not be applicable to many people, especially now the current estate tax exemption is at an all-time high. The federal estate tax exemption is $12.06 million, which means anybody who has less than that is exempt from paying estate tax. And the estate tax is taxed at a 50% rate, kind of. It's a virtual rate of 50%. If you're married, then you get to double that amount. You get to double that exemption amount, and this is the new or the current law as it stands, and it's set to sunset in a few years. But as it stands now, a married couple essentially has a bit over $24 million of free money, tax-exempt money, that they can transfer onto their children estate tax-free. There are current bills in Congress that are seeking to reduce that amount, that exemption amount, from $12 million down to $5 million. So far, they've been unsuccessful, but we are constantly monitoring it and seeing how that might go with the political landscape. Now, Maryland State, as do other states, New York, Massachusetts, other states have a state estate tax. And that exemption is a lot lower. It's not as high of a rate. It's only 16% of a taxable rate. But Maryland State says anything over $5 million is going to be taxed as an estate tax. And if you're married, you get to double it to $10 million. So it's important to understand how to deal with those issues should they arise. And people very frequently tell me, well, $5 million, I'm going to have close to $5 million. And I say, okay, let's go through your assets. And they say, okay, we have a house that's about $500,000, and we have some brokerage accounts and cash accounts, and I have a life insurance policy, a $4 million life insurance policy. Well, a $4 million life insurance policy, even though it's not included in your estate for probate purposes, because it goes to the death benefit, will go to the beneficiary you have designated during your life, but it is includable for estate tax purposes. So now you have to worry about an estate tax. And the way that we deal with that is we create marital trusts. All the tax-free money or the tax-exempt money will go into a family trust or a residuary trust for the children. And all the taxable money will be used during the surviving spouse during his or her lifetime. Before I turn it over to Rabbi Heineman, I want to quickly go through the role of trusts because that is a main part of an estate plan. We've already discussed the testamentary trusts, but there are trusts that can be created during lifetime. Very frequently, I mean, as a matter of course, we create trusts during lifetime, and those are created very much for the same reasons that testamentary trusts are created. We can create trusts to protect minors. We can create trusts for estate tax purposes. sometimes income tax planning purposes. We create trusts for business planning purposes. We'll transfer business assets into trust before they appreciate in order to make sure that we've removed a great deal of wealth from a person's individual estate. And ensure that a business can run smoothly as directed in a trust agreement. We create trusts to avoid probate. Probate is the process of submitting, filing the will with the Register of Wills in the county where you pass away. It could be a lengthy process. It could be an expensive process. But by transferring assets to a trust during your lifetime, you avoid that process. So what are the different types of trusts? And what are their statuses in halacha? I'm not going to discuss the halachic aspect of it, but I will go through the different types of trust, and it's really broken down into two types of trust. The first one is a trust that is revocable, and that's a trust that myself as the grantor, who's the creator of the trust, will transfer assets into a trust. I can be the trustee of that trust, and I can be the beneficiary of that trust, and I can also amend, revoke, modify, terminate, cancel. I can do whatever I want with that trust. That's a revocable trust. The IRS and the state says that trust is really an alter ego of yourself. That's not a separate person. That's just you, but a different pocket of yourself. You can do anything you want with this money. You can do anything you want with this trust. That trust is considered you, both for estate tax purposes, for creditor protection purposes. That's not a trust that's going to protect you. As opposed to an irrevocable trust. With an irrevocable trust, I'm the grantor of that trust. I'll create a trust. I'll transfer my assets to that trust. And I can't be the trustee, and I can't be the beneficiary of that trust. Nor can I modify it. I can't amend it. I can't change it in any way. The IRS and the state say that type of trust you will not be considered the owner of. Because you have no rights in that trust anymore. You've said it, you forget it, but you can't do anything else with it. In halacha, it's very likely that some of the halachic issues in terms of disinheriting halachic heirs and protecting wives and being makai Yerusha Bechor provisions for a revocable trust, it's not considered like I've really done anything, so a lot of those halachic issues are still something that we have to deal with. As opposed to an irrevocable trust, which is really a separate entity, it's a separate taxpayer, it's a separate thing. I no longer own these assets. Maybe those halachic issues would not be as prevalent. And with that, I will turn it over to Rabbi Heinemann.
Thank you very much. I want to talk about the wills in general, how they can be effective according to the halacha. There's one major problem with the will, and that is, in the will it says that if I pass away, I want this entity to get this amount, I want this child to get this amount, my wife to get this amount, whatever it is. But once a person passes away, he doesn't own his property anymore, and he cannot give it to anyone. That's the halachic problem with every will that's made in the regular way. There are two ways how we can make a will effective according to the halacha. One of them is that after you make a regular will, you go to the lawyer and you say, tell him what you want, and he makes a regular will. You if the law is you can do it with him, or you can do it with someone else. You make a kinyan, and you say that everything that I've said in this will, whoever's supposed to get my assets, I want to give it to them an hour or a minute before I pass away. So that you can do. When a person's alive, he can give anything to anyone he wants. If he does that, there is saying that he actually has no money when he passed away. He had no assets when he passed away because he gave everything away. So there is no Yerusha. But there is a mitzvah of Yerusha. Now, according to the Torah, the sons, the wife does not inherit her husband. The husband doesn't inherit his wife for this, if she has any assets of her own. A wife does not inherit her husband. The bechor of the son is a bechor. He gets twice as much as the other sons, but the daughters get nothing. That's the din of the Torah. However, already from a long time, hundreds of years, it has been the custom to give the daughters also part of the Yerusha. And the way that it's done is that way, that you say they should get it an hour before I die. Now, there's a problem with saying that, an hour before I die. Because at that time, you have to make a kinyan. You have to make an act of acquisition. So you can do it, you can do it yourself, you have to do it with someone else. If you have a firm lawyer, you can say, you give me something, and this is a barter. It's called a kinyan sudah. You give me something of yours. Let's say it's a COVID mask, or whatever you have. You want to give me a yarmulke, you want to give me anything. And you are representing all the people that I mention in my will. And then when I pick it up from you, then whatever we have said now will work. That it's a kinyan. But the problem is, you can't make a kinyan that way. Because I give him back, if I'm making the will, I'm giving him back his mask or whatever he made the kinyan with. And at the time that it's supposed to be effective, an hour before he dies, or a minute before he dies, doesn't make any difference. At that point, the thing he made the kinyan with is not there. I gave it back. I would keep it and put it in a safety deposit box. Maybe it would help. But it's not there anymore. So the answer to the way around that is that you made the kinyan, it should help me achshav, it should start now, v'shok and misa, and should be completely effective a minute or an hour before death. So since it's starting now, and now there is a kinyan, it grows, so to speak, by itself, and then there is kosher. So you make the kinyan that I'm having in my will, I'm giving it to the people, the entities which I want to give it to, and should take effect, may achshav, starting now, b'shok kaid misa, and an hour before death. That's the typical, that's one way of doing it. So then there's no Yerusha. Now there is the din of Yerusha, it's a mitzvah of Yerusha. So what you can do is like this. You say, this is all, this kinyan only helps for everything I have besides $10,000. And the $10,000 that I have, which I didn't give to anyone, so that I own still before death. So that $10,000 I want should be divided according to the din of the Torah. And now I'm just saying $10,000 doesn't have to be $10,000, it could be $5,000 also. But it should be, you can't say $5. It has to be something which is chosher. So then the boys will get it, the b'chor will get twice as much, and you have fulfilled the mitzvah of Yerusha. Now some people say that it should take effect on everything I have except my svarim. And the svarim should be divided based on their value between my boys, and the b'chor will get twice as much, and the others will, so if you have five boys, so you divide to six parts, each one gets one part, and the Chayav will get two parts. Now, there's a lot of things that have to be considered. It's not so simple. Number one, the only time that we say that a bechor gets twice as much is only if the father is the one who's passing away and giving, and they're inheriting the father. But if the father says that when I die, I want all my assets to go to my wife, which is unless he has a lot of money, it's the right thing to do. Because, according to the Gemara, when a person passes away, he has to let his wife live in his house, and he has to support her until she gets married to someone else. That's a type of alimony that he's required to do that. Now, according to the strict halacha, the boys would inherit, and she could go to them and ask them for money that she needs for support. And it's not only food, but it's all things, even to give stopper to people that knock on the door. The Gemara says that they have a right to ask for that, so that she shouldn't be considered like a stingy woman if she doesn't have any money. So that's part of, she should live like she lived before when her husband was alive. And everything that she needs to live a normal life based on the standard of living that she lived with her husband, she has the right to maintain. So according to strict halacha, the boys were the yashin, and she would ask them for money. But it's not a nice thing for a person to subject his wife that she has to ask money for the children. And especially if they say, I've seen a lot of things happen because the Yerusha is not planned properly, like we just heard before. And so they say, you need $500 a week for your upkeep. We think that $350 is enough. And then she has to go, we're not talking about the rent, she still is in the house without her. So, and of course, if there's tax on the house, this all has to come out of the estate. So, and she might even have to go to Dintara. Who wants his wife to have to go to Dintara with the children? It is not disgusting for a person to do that. Give all the money to her wife. And then you can make some, since you're being machnet with a kinyan, you have a right to say that you can live the way we live till now. I mean, sometimes there's things that cost more years than you roof on the house. It might cost you $10,000 or more. So you have to rent that. That's all part of being in my house. And and this way, she doesn't have to go to the children. So you should give it to the daughter. But you can say that whatever's left, she would have to make a will. And the whoever's left, that he could say that I wanted to go to our children, not to other children, which was mentioned before. He had the right to make to any stipulation, since he's giving it to her. It's not an automatic. It's not an automatic Yerusha. Now, when he does that, the bechor does not get pishnayim, because it's only from the father, but not if the mother dies. Now, if the father did not write in his will that he wants to give everything to his wife, but the children have upon us on the mother and they want to let her take everything. So the question is now, who does this money belong to? Is the money still part of the Yerusha of the husband who died because it wasn't given to the proper heirs, and therefore if the wife dies, the prayer will get pishnayim because it's really the money of the husband who died, or not? there's issues. I want to say something else. Why? It's not so simple. If someone dies and he has $100,000 in the bank, sometimes money in the bank is the safest way to take care of your assets. So, is that money, does the Bechor get Pishnayim for that money? I don't think so. Because the Torah says that losses like Pishnayim Bechor Asher Yimotzei Lai, he only gets Pishnayim from what he has, but not what he's supposed to get. Now, the money in the bank, I think that some people don't understand. The money in the bank is lent to the bank. You lend the bank. They don't put the money in the safe deposit vault. They take that money and they invest it in whatever they want to invest it in, and they have a right to do that. And technically, a bank can go bankrupt. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you. So a bank can go bankrupt. They make a bad investment and they can't pay the money to the depositors. If they go bankrupt, so then the people lose money. They're insured by the government to a certain amount. But it happened over here with a bank about 30 years ago.
Levitt was the person that the bankruptcy.
Okay, but it took a long time for the people to get the money, even though it was insured.
If they even got it.
Yes, that's true. So what I'm trying to say is it's lent to them. Money which is lent is not considered b'chol asher yimotzei lo'i, that's what you have. Now, why don't you have money in stocks? Or a retirement plan which is heavily invested in stocks. It doesn't have to be, but it usually is. The question is if you're running stock, you actually own part of the company. So if you own part of the company, is that considered the Bechor Gets Pishnayim, because it says Bechor Asher Yimotzei Lo'i? Or maybe Rav Moshe Feinstein says, and this has to do with Chametz on Pesach. What happens if you have stock in General Motors? And General Motors has a cafeteria. And over there they have Chametz. So are you allowed to keep the stock over Pesach or not? So, and if you can't keep it over Pesach, you can just put it in with your Chametz. You can't sell stock that way. You can only sell it over the stock market. So what are you supposed to do with this? And General Motors is just an example. Many companies have chametz, even if the principal business is not chametz, but they have chametz. And you, an owner of this company, right? Because you own a stock of the company. So much time it says that if you have a stock in AT&T, American Telephone Telegraph, when you go past the building, do you say to yourself, "Oh, what a beautiful company I have"? No, you don't consider yourself an owner of the company. Well, you go, you have a stock in General Motors, and you go past one of their places. You don't say, like, "What a beautiful company I have." You don't consider your company, and they don't consider you an owner of the company. When you walk in, they have the red carpet for you because you're an owner. They don't consider you an owner, and you don't consider yourself an owner. And the only way, in the according to the Torah law, that's considered ownership is only if it's a meeting of the minds. If both parties have to understand that there is a something has been gone from one person to another person. And if there's no meeting of the mind that way, so not that you think you own the company, not they think you own the company, even though legally you own the company, a part of the company is not considered kin. So therefore you don't own the company and you have to worry about the chums in the company. Now, if you have, let's say, $1 billion worth of stock in General Motors, so then maybe you went in for a walk past it when you drive past the company. You do think, "What a beautiful company I have." But then $1 billion is nothing to sniff at, at least not for me.
Don't look at me, me neither.
So then you do have to get rid of the stock if you have this chametz in the company. But it is if you have even 100 stocks of a company, it's not considered chosher. And if you have $1 billion in it, they will roll out the red carpet for you when you come in and visit the place. So therefore, if it's not yours, and you have money in stocks, there's no din of it's not his. It's not considered an ownership, even though legally it's considered an ownership, it's not considered an ownership of $1. So there are certain limitations on this Pishnai. But I said in the past there was a minig that a person used to write a shtar chatzi zocher for a daughter. That when they got married, the father of the kala insisted that the chazan write out a document to say that if he passed away, that she'll get half as much as one of the sons would get. The idea behind that was the Torah says just the son should get, and to just push that away is not proper. So we'll make a compromise over here between the Torah and what we're going to do, that she'll get half as much, and so the boys will get more. Okay, but it's not necessary to do that. We don't usually do that today to write a shtar chatzi zocher, but the person wants to give his daughters the same amount he wants to give his sons, since he's giving it over during his lifetime, so he doesn't have it when he dies. He doesn't have anything except for this $10,000, which she says that should be divided according to the halacha. So if he has $500,000, so the girls basically will get their share, either even share like a boy, and the boys will get, if there's five boys, each one will get $5,000 either. Said, so each one will get $1,000, or if there's a bechera, they would according that way. Now, one of the things is mentioned, if one boy is in Kail, one of the sons in Kail, and the other one is in business, do you want to give them the same amount? So, if this is a question, in other words, one who's in Kail needs it more, and he maybe needs it to stay in Kail, and the other one's in business, doesn't need it so much, he's making a nice promise. When it comes to these kind of things, it depends on the way that the children will understand it. If the one who's in business understands that it is that his brother who was in Kail needs it more and he's willing to go along with that, there will be no machlokes. But if they will fight about it already, and that they think it's not equitable to do something like that, they're going to rethink it. Matter of fact, when I wrote a will, actually, Rav Aaron Giver was the one who wrote it. I mean, he was the one who did the work. So
I did the work.
You did the work? Okay. All right, so...
I want to get your credit.
Oh, so before we finalized it, I sent it to all my children, Baruch Hashem, and asked them if they have any... if they have anything they want, things they want to say about it. They think something that we did was not fair. Like some of the things that we have are not divisible. Like it was mentioned before, the diamond ring. You can cut up the diamond into four parts. If the diamond ring is worth $5,000, you cut into four parts. Each part is worth $200. It doesn't add up to the total. Because the bigger the stone is, the more that value it has. So I sent out to my children, and they had some things to say which I think wasn't fair. And so we took care of it, and then we gave over to the to Schleimer, and he put it into writing. Now, as was mentioned before, and this is something very important. So when should a person write a will? How old is he supposed to be to write a will? So Rav Sernel, Baruch Hashem, said that when you're 50 years old, you should write a will. Mm. Now, of course, if a person 50 years old writes a will, it's not going to help if he passes away before 50. Well, a person doesn't have to, let's put it that way, he doesn't have to be worried that he's going to die before 50. So, of course, it all depends on a person's health. Even healthy people can die young, so there's no rules. A person doesn't know when he's 30 years old what he's going to have, what are the ramifications, what's going to be with his children. If the children are still young at that point, he doesn't know which, maybe his special needs children. He doesn't know which children are going to learn to play, or which ones are not learning. It's not really so. It's not so smart to make a will, and that's going to be the will for your life. Even if you make it to 50, every 10 years, it's good that a person should re-think about the will. And especially if you make the will kosher, according to the way that I said, you must redo it every 10 years or so, because the kinyan that you make only helps on what you have at the time of the kinyan. But if you, let's say, you get an inheritance, or you make a lot of money, and there's a big difference later on what there's no kinyan, which would only go according to the boys according to the strict halacha. So then you would have to make another kinyan. There's another way how to do it. The other way how to do it is you go to one of your daughters and you say, let's say your assets that you believe are $1 million. You say to this daughter, I admit that I owe you $2 million. And when I die, I don't have the money now, but when I die, you can take the money out of the inheritance. On the condition that you give your other sister, $100,000, and you give your brother $100,000, and you write whatever you want to divide it up according to what you have. So that's what it's, that's workable, and that will help even if you buy things later. But there is a different problem. There could be a big hitch with taxes over here. I believe that the law is that if you lend someone money, even with no interest, you lend to from Eve. I believe the government will make you pay taxes on the interest that you could have got. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, so Rav Sherman says that's true. So then, if someone says, I owe you $2 million, that means that even though it's not true, it doesn't owe, but once you say that you owe it, so it becomes, according to Allah, we say a person is believed to say something is negative to him, we say he's believed. And so then there may be tax implications that this thing would have to go to court.
Would that chub have to be enforceable in civil law or only in a vest?
Only in a vest. So, but sometimes it goes to court. I've seen families that have been pulled apart. They became enemies, one or the other, over Yerusha. So you never know what's going to happen. Now, the Siddur Shulchan Aruch.
Okay.
It says in Shulchan Aruch that a person should try to treat all his children equally. Even if one is a bad son and one is a good son, you should give them the exact amount of money. So Ramesh Bhatia says that that's only if the bad son, he doesn't get up to the davening in the morning, he sometimes forgets to make a bracha. But if he's off the derech completely, he doesn't believe in anything, then you don't believe in anything. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't do anything. I'm telling you, I'm going to end with this myself with a big rebbe, that he had sons, the one son was completely off the derech. He treated all the people, including the son who didn't keep anything. So they asked him, you know, you have a limited amount of money, and you have many children. Why do you want to give this son who doesn't keep anything, who doesn't have any shaykhus with Yiddishkeit, why do you want to give him money? He said, when I come up to heaven after 120 years, and the Rav Arjun will say to me, how come you didn't learn, you haven't learned Torah for 8 hours a day, you didn't learn for 12 hours a day? How come you only gave 60% of your money to soccer and you didn't give more? And other complaints like that. So the Rebbe said, I will say that the Baruch Hashem should do with me, neither can ever neither, in the same way that I took care of my son, who was not from and didn't take it. Even they didn't keep anything. So the Baruch Rebbe wants on me, I'm not worse than that son, and support me also. Thank you, Father.